storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vimeir Dees. Welcome to this episode of Class War Battlefield Podcast. I gotta tell y'all, it feels good to be back. You know, it feels good to be wanting to do these again and doing these again after a time of just immense uncertainty. It feels good to be back. I was about to say it feels good to be black, but it does feel good to be black. I love being black, but it does. It feels good to be back. The beginning of the year when there was that school shooting down in Florida where a bunch of white kids were killed and everybody was talking about school shootings. I wanted to produce a podcast episode then, but it just wasn't. It wasn't physically possible. So, and consider this kind of that episode. There's a point that I want to start off making. Is that the cumulative effect of Americana. It's kind of funny. I got to point this out. There's Americana and there's American. And I've been searching because I believe there is an essence to the word American which can be found on this continent. I haven't found it yet, but I believe it's here. And I believe it's amongst the Native Americans. That's why for a long time it was Americana. I mean, they talk about American, but they were very strict about Americana and the difference between Americana and American. That said, though, the cumulative effect of Americana, of American life, is what is feeding these shootings. It just so happens that within a few months, I think it was 2 months prior to the shooting in Florida, I had found this incredible lecture given by John Telegatto. And I've mentioned this man before because I really think, you know, there's certain people that has keys. They have these mysterious keys to answering the questions of why and what and how. There's certain people who do that. And John Telegatto, I believe, has some of those keys. He, in 1999, this man he speaks about, by the way, in case you don't know of him, he's now kind of retired. He had some health issues that sidelined him, but he spoke about the reason for education, and particularly public education, and how it was really meant to dumb down the American populace, not make them smarter. Not make them smarter. So he did this for years. And in 1999, he was called in to give a lecture by the parents of Littleton, Colorado. Those of you who may not be old enough to know what Littleton, Colorado is or where it is or why it's important, that is where the Columbine shooting happened. Now, some of you still may not know what that means because I'm aware that You know, the Columbine shooting happened 20 years ago next year, next April. 20 years ago next April. Or really this coming up April, should I say. So, there's a whole lot of people who didn't hear about that, or who weren't alive for it. Around 20 people were killed. And at that time, it was a shock because it was the worst school shooting that ever occurred. And there had not been any school shooting like that. I mean, there had been school shootings, but they had not been like that. They had not been like that. So he was called in by the parents to kind of give a lecture on education and how it may have fed into the creation of the atmosphere that pushed and propelled those boys to kill their classmates. So he did. In 2001, he gave an abbreviated and updated version, maybe not abbreviated, but definitely an updated version of that speech to a C-SPAN audience. That is what I found. I actually found it on YouTube and listened to it probably about a dozen times. And what he realized, because he did some research before he went to give the lecture, what he found was that, I think it was in 1994, there was a move by the school board, which had, I guess, traditionally been a collaborative effort between the community, the parents, and the staff, the faculty, to sever that tie, that communal tie, and to shift to a performance-based system, you know, what we today call standardized, you know, testing and performance and crap like that, that no other Western democracy or country is doing. No other Western country is doing this. So he found this. He found out that this occurred, and then he dug deeper into it and discovered an interview that the new, I believe, superintendent had given to some magazine. I want to say Education Weekly, but don't quote me on that. And he found this quote. He found this quote where the new superintendent, you know, the parents were really angry about this change. They had, the old system had been working for decades. It had produced incredible results, amazing results. And so they did not want to do this. And I guess there was some people who made the statement that this could be harmful in one way, in more than just curricular activities. And the superintendent made a statement similar to, maybe not exactly this way, but he made a statement of saying, like, come on, guys, it's not that serious. It's not as if we are actually shooting people. That, you know, it's not as if our kids will be shooting people because of the result of this. And this was in something like 94 or 95. So when he found this, he delivered that to Littleton, Colorado when he went and he spoke. And, you know, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see what the people actually, what they said once when he made that statement. Because it was telling, and it was also chilling. Something else that he pointed out, and this is actually more important, I think, more than just the standardized nonsense that has been occurring to dumb people down, because that's what it's been doing. It's meant to dumb you down. He pointed to the reaction of the student body president, who was a senior that year. So he was getting ready to graduate. When asked something about returning to school, the senior said, you know, this is like a second home to me, or this is like home to me, something to that effect. And to you, this may not seem very big. It's like, oh, well, there's a lot of people who think of school as, second home. There's a lot of people who don't. The reason why it hit me, and it also, it struck him as odd, is because what does that say about their own home? If the person could say that this is a second home to me, or this is like a home to me, what does that say about their own home? Well, the two boys who murdered all of those kids showed us what it was saying about home. Parents were not involved in their kids' lives. These kids were able to build bombs, test those bombs, purchase and utilize guns without parents even knowing. What were those parents doing? Well, they were working, obviously. Well, if you know the community which Dylan Kleiboard and Eric something, it's been years, but Eric Harris, I think, was his name. But if you know the community which they came from, it's a pretty well-to-do community. Money. They got money. So, working, yes, but also maybe a little bit of splurging. And this was actually in the 90s. The detachfulness or the detachness, I don't know which word I want to use for that, but parental detachment, there you go. That was what grunge was about. It was talking about the loneliness of young people. The loneliness of the teenagers that grew up then. And how their parents were always working and did not have time for them and were always showering them with material things that didn't mean anything. That had no meaning whatsoever. And these two boys actually took that loneliness to its logical, well, not maybe logical, but definitely a conclusion that was attention-getting or grabbing. Fast forward to today. And Columbine definitely has something to say to us. Because parental detachment has increased. Childhood isolation has increased also. Children feel isolated, terribly isolated. And when I think about what these kids today, how they relate to people, how they relate to community, how they relate to each other, I see the desperation, the need to be loved, the need to be nurtured. And very few parents who want to nurture. Who can and want to nurture. And look, it's a cycle. It really is. It's a cycle. I feel that there were moments in, I can't call it the recent past, but in the past 85 years, where this cycle really clicked and started running rapid. And the isolation of the family, which could be said to have started with the culture shifting to suburbs and single family units and the breaking up of communities so that everything was very widespread and homes were very well set apart. Everything was zoned. Everything had to be in a correct zone. So all of your stores and your industry were zoned and the community wasn't really connected to those zones, or periodically they would be, but most often they wouldn't be. I grew up in a community where there were still businesses that were embedded in the community. there were still businesses that were embedded in the community. And that isolation, coupled with fathers who went to war in World War II, never to talk about what actually happened. I was talking to somebody actually about this the other day. Never to be able to talk about. Most of them never told their children or their grandchildren, some even great-grandchildren, what they saw, what they did, and how they had to do it. Most of us have no clue about any of that. None of us have, you know, we don't have any idea. But what's funny is, you know, there's this saying, which I'm going to butcher, which states that you can't hide anything from the cosmos. The cosmos will bring everything out from you, even when you don't think it's possible. So what you don't say, what you don't express, what you aren't able to purge from your psyche and your emotions comes out in your children. And sometimes even in your grandchildren. And so that personal isolation of the male. And then you had women who are similarly isolated. We don't talk about the burden of war on the female. But they were similarly isolated. And they were actually, what's funny is, when the men went off to war, women didn't remain in the kitchen. Many went to war with them as nurses, and some did a little bit of fighting. But also, many went to work at the factories, and many more supported the factory workers and kept the community strong. But there was a deep isolation and loneliness there, too, with that. Because with a lot of men gone, you know, we forget, you're talking about millions of men that went to actually fight and millions more that went to support them. With that isolation, with the community being almost devoid of males, females, there's needs that females have that were taken care of by other females. So you had an increase in lesbianism during this time. You had empowerment of women during this time to take on careers and to be leaders in the community. Women realized in World War II, this is something I'm surprised that hasn't really been written about much, you know. Women realized in World War II that they could control things because they had whole regions where they had to take care of the communities in that region, the economic interests and everything else, and they were able to do it. So that then when you had men coming back from the front, coming back from war, and they just said, look, you need to get back into the kitchen and you need to be the dutiful little wife and everything needs to be hunky-dory like it was before, which really wasn't the case, but let's just say that's what it was. Women looked and said, yeah, we don't think that's really going to happen. And that's when, you know, you saw the beginnings of the women's movement in the post-World War II era. You saw that. And the family structure began shifting and changing. And I'd like to say it's indicative of how American life was shifting and changing, but that might be a little bit too far. What I can say is that ultimately the contradictions of the old way to live, which were always evident, were emphasized and the family structure, which could have been adapted, it could have really been adapted to this new reality. You know, in Europe, they actually adapted their family structures pretty well, but then again, Europe was building from pretty much scratch. because the family wasn't adaptable, because men weren't treated per se for their terrible PTSD and all of the horrors that, the psychological horrors that come from war, which, by the way, didn't help that within 6 years you had Korea. With that being the reality, families were hamstrung and tortured by the terror that was PTSD, and many of the other illnesses that are afflicted, you know, when one goes to war and sees what war brings. And then women who were silently stewing because they were being made to feel powerless when, if it had not been for their genuine support and their genuine encouragement. You know, we read now, or we hear now on World War II documentaries how women sent these beautiful letters to the men. And men cherish these letters, you know, for decades. But we fail to realize, you know, we think, oh, well, that's what a woman's supposed to do. But we really fail to realize that it was often those letters that kept men's morale and gave them something to look forward to long enough so they could actually survive. So if it wasn't for them doing these things, man couldn't have won those, couldn't have won that war. And now they're being asked to just be quiet, to be Gentile, to not engage much. I mean, they did still. I mean, to not engage much in politics or, you know, the ruling of the region, the community, or anything like that, when just a few years back, they were the only ones that could do it because all the men were gone. Now, people, I think, who rightly want to connect certain aspects of the women's movement to the CIA and intelligence, they fail to understand these dynamics. The child caught in the middle of daddy's PTSD and mommy's anger at daddy, because daddy, one, isn't the same person he was when he left, is angrier, is more stern and stubborn, and what, and various other characteristics that afflicted many men. But also, she herself feels resentful because she cannot fully express herself and is told every day that she shouldn't because she's a woman. And yet, she was able to do a lot, without men telling her that she couldn't do it. And so all of this spills into the child. And so the child is confused and dazed and spun about. And in this new world of suburban culture, which was springing up rapidly in the post-World War II years, this is for, you know, white families. I want to make that very clear, because this is something that's going to be coming out more in the white community. So I want you to be very clear. I ain't talking mostly about black folks. It did happen there, but this is a majority white thing that I'm talking about. So when they leave home, still isolated, still frustrated, still confused about many things, you know, it is these people that sought to overturn the culture and didn't understand the culture enough, or even understand what they needed in order to make the culture different. It is them who were 15 to 20 years old to 25 years old between the years of 1965 and 1975 when they were trying to do the counterculture to change the culture, because they were the children who were affected and infected with that culture. They knew it had to change. They understood. It wasn't to them. It wasn't about civil rights. It was about the American cultural body had been poisoned and had created this disfigurement within them. Then they knew it, and they could feel it. They may have not been able to talk about it. They may not have been able to describe it. They may not have been able to articulate it. But they knew that it was there and that it had to change. That's who these people were. This is why they were so desperately talking about love, because a lot of them had felt as if they were devoid of love. Devoid of love. And this is something that Dr. King actually rightfully understood and talked about. And there were many people talking about this, but not a lot of people listening. You had an isolated generation that was unable to function appropriately and take its rightful place as a generation force because it had been so distracted. Now, I say distracted, knowing that the word, as we understand it, needs to be, in this context, slightly redefined, because distract, T-R-A-C-K, is what I'm talking about. So they had been distracted by this force which was external to them, which came from their parents, which was imprinted on them, which stopped them from realizing their broader truth, which was meant to really revolutionize the world. Some people could do it. Some young people could do it. But most of them were too confused to actually get there. And that confusion didn't stop. The influx of drugs into their communities only worsened that. So wasn't the invention of, not the invention of, the widespread use and expansion of TV. As this new pop culture concept started really invading their spaces, their worlds, and turning them into miniature consumer machines or consumption machines, where all they thought about was consuming, and they didn't want that. They felt the stranglehold that that was putting on them, so they sought something different. It didn't work, and it didn't work because the parents of that generation and a few amazingly self-centered and rigid individuals of their own generation sought to not only stop them, but to defeat them from putting in this new counterculture, because it was all about money for them. It wasn't about the greater good. And so then you move on from that generation, from the baby boomers, who really did have a beautiful vision for the world. Some of them, a lot of them, not all of them. And now they become the young urban professionals that are incredibly self-centered and selfish in the 80s, in the late 70s. They too have a generation of kids. They too have a generation of kids. And these kids are even further confused. These kids are even further confused. Why? Because their parents, who were really seeking a better world and were willing to do anything to get it because they understood, even though they couldn't explain it, they understood how bad that world had really crunched them down and defeated them. Their parents, now under the heavy influence of pop culture, which many were still fighting, and the influx of a new Christianity, which claimed prominence from, you know, decades early, years, hundreds of years earlier, and really, really brainwashed a lot of people into believing that they themselves were evil. that they themselves were evil. And if they thought a certain way, which ironically was leftist, it was never, you know, corporatist. If you were talking about corporate things and capitalism and consumerism, you were on God's side. But if you were talking about cooperatives and commonwealth and being neighborly and not giving in to consumerism, for some reason, God wasn't interested in none of that. He wasn't interested in that. So now their brains completely scrambled by this new form of thinking and this new liberalism, which was pretty much conformist in theory. These people now gave birth to a new generation. A new generation. You know, it's weird because between 65 and 75, you had... Between 65 and 75, you had a generation which really was part radical and part realist, where they knew the struggle was going to be long, but they knew it had to be waged. And you see this in a lot of the culture that these people were creating. A lot of these people from the 65 to 75 era, and a few, you know, obviously before and after, but they are the ones that really spearheaded the new cultural movements of the late 80s into the early and mid 90s. And they are the ones that they had to stop. But the new generation after that, 75 to 85, maybe even 90, these people were massively, massively, massively confused. Absolutely, it's pitiful how confused these children were and how isolated they were. Now, their parents, who now were really buying into this new Christian fundamentalist, pro-capitalist concept, really went to work hard for their family. But they did it in both ways. They actually did succeed in many instances in giving their children the best of both worlds, or trying to anyway. So they would get decent jobs, and be able to give them a pretty comfortable lifestyle. And oftentimes the parents would be somewhat nurturing. Strict, but nurturing. What was often missing was a real sense of the world and how it was evolving. So this actually led to, you know, the generation that gave rise to these people, you know, who were born from 75 to 85, maybe 90, their idea of nurturing was kind of a little bit skewed. They were more hands-off than hands-on, and were more likely to take parental advice not from communal members, but from so-called experts. Experts. And I've actually, you know, John Telegazzo talks about this among other documentaries, which I've seen, that this shift of relying on experts actually has been detrimental to every field that has become dominated by experts, because there's no real life experience that's backing up their judgments. And so, as these people pretty much became science experimenters, where they were looking at their children as, well, maybe I could do this, maybe I could do that, maybe, instead of doing things that had been working. One of the weird things that came out of this time period from 65 to 85, is this generation which didn't want to listen to the previous generation. Because there wasn't that continuity of what had been done before should be done now. It was just more isolation piled on more isolation. So the isolation felt by the parents was impressed onto the children. And the children themselves, who were already feeling isolated in the culture itself, because the culture was pushing isolation. then felt more isolated because of what their parents, felt. So they had that internal isolation already, and then the society piled on more. So this confusion was magnified. And it is that 75 to 85 generation that started grunge. It is that 75 to 85. They understood that strict, stripping isolation that strangled them and caused their mental faculties to run empty and their emotionality to just be cold. They understood that. So they said, we can't take the glitter and glance while everything else is horrible. You know, that I heard somebody mention this, so I don't want to, you know, give you this bit of information and be like, well, I thought about this. No, I didn't think about this. I heard someone else say this. Grunge essentially looked at the glitz and glam of the 1980s rock groups and said, we ain't doing none of that crap because life sucks. And that's exactly what they did. This is why if you go back and you check grunge, I'm talking about the people who were actually doing it, not the Johnny-come-latelys who were like, oh, well, now we're going to do grunge because, you know, it's selling. You know, if you look at what was happening in Seattle, if you look at what the groups that were coming out of Seattle, what you see is people getting up there with old jeans and old sweaters and things like that, because it was to say, look, I'm real. And the music that I'm talking about, the music that I'm about to sing to you, this is real. This is about being real. And a lot of the lyrics that came out were really, you listen to them, and they had to deal with this crushing loneliness and this crushing isolation and the contradictions of the parents, which were saying this and saying that, doing this and doing that. And yet, they were telling them, the grunge generation, to do something completely different. And this, you could see this, you could hear it in what they were talking about in the music. Now, when it's kind of ironic, the first, I think, if memory serves me correctly, the first major publicized school shooting in a white school, because I got to imagine there were some before this, was around 95. It was 95 or 96. And it just so happens that that coincided with when pop music went from one level to another, when just all of these record labels, I think record labels were actually also in this, but all of these radio stations were being bought up, and this new corporatized pop music was being shoved into the American psyche. That pop music was not the pop music we have today. Obviously, it was stripped down emotionally, mentally, psychologically, spiritually. It was stripped down music that sounded decent, but didn't have any real substance. Didn't have a lick of real substance. So that was the first one. And by 1999, this corporate takeover was very, very much advanced and was really kind of over, because I think at the time, Clear Channel, which now is iHeartRadio, you know, they rebranded themselves. Clear Channel, which was hated, you know, throughout the late 90s, throughout the first decade of this century, and then they rebranded themselves. Clear Channel owned something like 1,500, it might have doubled by now or something, but they owned ridiculous amounts of radio stations and owned a lot of power. I mean, they could control millions without even thinking about it. So by 99, with all of this happening, you know, you have Britney Spears, Backstreet Boys, NSYNC. You have all of these people making music at in an arena where just 6 years prior, you had an incredible diversity of music. An incredible... Go back to 93 and actually listen. I mean, you're going to hear some pop stuff, but listen to the diversity of pop music. Even of pop music. It was insane that by 1999, that diversity was unheard of. In fact, if it wasn't for Ricky Martin's surprising rise, pop music would have been just bland, you know, girl and boy bands. But by that time, that's when you had Columbine. So the evolution of the isolation, the no way of really expressing that isolation, of draining off that isolation. You know, everybody wanted to point to the fact that these kids listen to Marilyn Manson. And while, you know, I don't listen to Marilyn Manson, I've never listened to Marilyn Manson, really. To me, I said, who cares? That the music didn't make them kill people. If that was the case, you know, there's millions of people who listen to Marilyn Manson. Why aren't there millions of Columbines? If then we realize that that generation from 75 to 85 themselves were isolated and kept apart from themselves and kept apart from healing their families and kept apart from healing the wounds of society, we only realize that it's been compounding to the point where I think, and I hate to say this, but I really mean this, I think you have a generation that feels dead. That feels absolutely dead. And nobody's hearing them. Nobody's feeling them. Nobody is concerned with them. Because we've been taught that that's normal. As if that is the right... That is the right thing to be. That deadness, that feeling of isolation and loneliness is correct. Now, I would be remiss if I did not say that in seeking to curb these crimes, implementing a policy where more police officers are put into schools with guns, with weapons, isn't the answer. You gotta change the culture which is producing the isolation and loneliness. That is the only answer. And if we are not willing to do that, if we are not willing to succeed in doing that, we won't ever, ever fix this problem. We won't do it. Alright, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you know, you can reach out to me via my email. And as I said, it feels good to be back. This is your brother Vimer Dees. Until next time, peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.